And for me, as a young strength coach in the tactical strength and conditioning space, early on, I started kind of thinking about how the tactical athlete is fundamentally different from a football player, a basketball player, or whatever the sort of quote unquote institutional NSCA philosophies were. Those didn't apply to tactical athletes. And so what would it look like to sort of change the mind of an entire industry? So that was my maybe connection here between some of the things that I think about and where this book fits in my philosophical canon, if you will. I guess we can do an intro.
Should we banter about something? I don't know how we do this.
I do. So I have something. Hey guys, welcome back. Another week. Drew and Maddox Mosmos. I started today listening to a new podcast series that I'm going to plug. My daughter's pediatrician recommended this, and he talked for quite a long time. But Dolly Parton's America.
Okay.
Very excited about this one. This guy,
Dolly
this,
Parton sponsors the pod.
yeah, shout out Dolly. Big fan. This guy, I'm 17 and a half minutes into the first episode. I think there was nine. This Lebanese American journalist was at a Dolly. I think the background was that he was like at a Dolly Parton concert and looked around and like there's ultra conservative, like Make America Great Again cowboys and like cross dressing, like super left wing. And everybody's just singing along to Dolly. He's like, what is this cultural phenomenon that does Dolly Parton? So I'm excited.
Definitely aligns. Like all the same listeners for our podcast are probably gonna be all about that podcast because they're so
Yeah,
similar.
I think there's a lot of crossover. We've talked about creating our own theme park, and Alex is looking into some plastic surgery. So it's definitely, there's way,
Was that a
actually, not,
suggestion?
I don't know, but more to follow, I think, in upcoming episodes of Mops and Mos as far as Dolly Parton is concerned. So anyway, what are we doing? What are we doing
I
this
think we're
week?
talking about books.
Yeah, we are talking about books. Yeah, so I guess for some context, you'll just be hearing from Alex and I tonight. We have no special guests, sorry, but we've talked now back and forth, I think for certainly a couple of weeks, but maybe even months about doing this episode. And the challenge was for each of us to come to the table, figuratively speaking, with five books that, what do you want to say, like shaped our careers, shaped how we think?
Yeah, shaped how we think about human performance, I think, is the
Sure, we'll
fair
call
way
that.
to cage this one. Yeah.
There you go. And so we each have five, and we'll go through these in really no particular order. At least for me, I don't really have a particular order here, but as is the way with us, we also have some honorable mentions. So the list is longer than 10, but we'll focus, I think, mostly on the five that we each brought. So
I will say normally Drew makes fun of me. Like if we have like listicle style stuff where we have to like pick three or pick five or something.
is
Usually
that a
I'm the
website?
one.
Listicle?
Yeah. It's a blog thing.
Sporkle. Shout out Sporkle. You ever do Sporkle?
Don't even know what Sporkle is.
Sporkle? Dude. So Sporcle. I don't know if it's still around. If you want to waste, for all our military audience, if you guys want to waste some good time at work, Sporkle is one of those like list quiz websites.
Interesting.
Yeah. No free ads, but Sporkle. Shout out.
There you go. But usually you say no free ads every time you do a free ad.
It's a bit.
Usually I am the one who comes with a bunch of extras because I wasn't able to narrow down my list, but this time Drew brought way more extras than I did.
I like books.
All right.
And I also just for people out there, coaches, I think specifically who speak publicly and give presentations, like have a slide on there that talks like books that you like. I love when I'm in a presentation and they have like, oh, here's some places you can go if you want to find out more about thing. Like I'm a
Nice.
sucker. I'm a sucker for that. So anyway,
Noted. Next presentation, book slide.
book slide. So I'll let you go ahead. You go first. Let's just kick this thing off. Pick one of your five.
I'm going first. All right. So I'll kick off my five. And actually, I'm going to preface this before I even say my first book by saying that clearly Drew picked more strength and conditioning oriented books than I did. That'll become clear as you hear his list and my list.
Well, you have zero, so.
Well, this first one is the most related to actual exercise out of my books. It's not the only one that discusses exercise, but it is the only one that's like actually about fitness. So I just want to say that up front that like I didn't expect this. I knew my books were going to be less like specific to like designing workouts and stuff like that. but I didn't realize until after I made my list and like chopped off the ones and picked my top five that like three of the five here are kind of about mental health. I didn't really see that one coming. Honestly, all of them to some degree have more to do with like cognition in your brain and mental health than they have to do with anything you do in the gym. So that was a little bit of a surprise for me. Anyway, book number one, Spark by John Rady. I don't have it in front of me, but I believe the subtitle is The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. I will be mildly critical for a second and say that the...
You are correct. I just looked it up for you. Correct.
Sweet. I will be mildly critical and say that the science is not that revolutionary or that new, but it is worth reading, and he does a fantastic job of explaining it, and it is like the first one I would recommend to people on this list. Like it is, if I had to say like, go read a book right now and you care about fitness and wellness and performance and health and stuff, I'd tell you to go read Spark right away.
We should get him on.
Yeah, I think he'd be good. He's very old now. I don't know if he's doing public appearances anymore.
Was like, he's like life support old, or he's just...
I mean, I'll check how old he is right now. Let's see. John Rady.
Like not doing public appearances the same way like Queen wasn't doing public appearances?
Yeah, I mean, he's 75 years old, so he's not super old, but he's pretty old. I'll see. We have a previous podcast guest who's a decent friend of Dr. Rady's. We can try that one, see if we can get him on.
There you go.
But the short version of what the book's about is all the things that exercise does for your brain, not just like your muscles and your heart and your lungs and things like that. A little bit of that is about like mood and mental health, but mostly it's about like, it improves your creativity. It improves your ability to learn things. It improves your like retention of things. Like there's particularly when you talk about aerobic type of exercise, the influence it has on your brain is absolutely massive. And I'll kind of leave it there because the book is like just like a series of digging into different topics on that stuff. I think it's fantastic. It's part of like reading it is part of like the beginning of where my career path pivoted towards health and performance kind of stuff. And then I did not list it on honorable mentions, but I'll do it as like a 1A under Spark. He also wrote a follow-up book.
I knew you were going to do this. Classic.
He wrote a follow-up book called Go Wild. It's similar, but it's more about like the role outdoor exercise plays compared to just like being on a treadmill farm inside a building that's air conditioned. Really, really good at tying in the outdoor element of all this stuff. Also by John Rady.
Beautiful. Okay, my turn. So let me look at my list. And again, these are, I guess, 2 points here. Number one, no particular order. Number two, we're going to have all of these in the show notes and we'll include links, and they may or may not be affiliate links. We haven't decided yet, but if you're scrambling to write these things down, don't worry about it. Just go to the website. The show notes will be there. So I am going to kick mine off with probably the book that I have had the longest as I'm looking at this list, and that would be Practical Programming for Strength Training. So basic. I know, but that was intentional. So for coaches that are coming from sort of the starting strength world, you will be obviously familiar with Mark Ripito. Practical Programming for Strength Training is what I would consider, and honestly, I think what they would probably consider as the sequel to that.
When he says that, he means Starting Strength.
Starting Strength. Yeah, the book Starting Strength.
Which I was surprised that Drew put Practical Programming on here and without putting Starting Strength on here.
Well, so here I'll explain. So Starting Strength is on my honorable mentions. And another one that is also on my honorable mentions as part of that lineage is The Strongest Shall Survive. So to give you, I guess, a little bit of background, Bill Starr, football strength coach, I believe in the 70s, Strongest Shall Survive was kind of the original book on that sort of 5x5 basic barbell strength training, back squat, bench press, deadlift, power clean. I went through a phase as a younger strength coach where I committed to reading one modern strength book a month and one old school strength book a month. And that's where Strongest Shall Survive came from. So anyway, that is what inspired Starting Strength. And then Starting Strength, like I mentioned, was sort of the prequel to Practical Programming. Now, why I picked Practical Programming over Starting Strength, I am a big fan of Andy Baker. Mark Ripito is great. He's a little bit inflammatory and he is diehard about the 5x5 method, which is fine. But Andy Baker is a little bit more of a nuanced kind of strength and conditioning coach when it comes to barbell training. And I think where Starting Strength does a good job introducing some of the physics behind barbell training and some of the basic templates, Practical Programming takes that and makes it much more practical. So it's less of like, here's this method and that method, and more of what would it look like to program for strength and hypertrophy? And it's in the title, practical. It's very practical programming. So I went intentionally basic with my first one because I was thinking back to myself as kind of a new strength coach, and some of the things that I wasn't necessarily taught in school when it comes to more of the practical program design stuff, I got from that book. I would probably change some things looking back now, but I mean, if you read that one and get familiar with sort of what it talks about, and then maybe layer some subjective autoregulation stuff on top of it, you're probably 95% of the way there in terms of how to actually get people stronger. So
I've had, my opinions have evolved on Mark Ripiteau over time. I too,
I'm sure he's great.
Early in my journey, definitely. I mean, they're still on my shelf. I've got Starting Strength. I've got Practical Programming, useful books, good stuff. And like, I use Ripiteau's How to Coach the Deadlift in 5 Steps method for like every beginner who's learning the deadlift for the first time. It works really, really well. But Mark Ripiteau today has gone like really far down the inflammatory road to the point of it being just like kind of annoying.
I haven't paid attention to
starting fights
in a
for
while.
No reason. Like, he used to be part of CrossFit, and then he had like the breakup with CrossFit, and now he like makes videos about how terrible CrossFit is that like aren't coherent and don't really have a clear point. A lot of straw man arguments kind of stuff. He made a whole video about how to properly carry plates around the gym, like the proper grip of how to hold it, like which way to put it, how to, like, it's,
I know what you're talking about with the metal plates and like the lip. Yeah. Yeah.
It's some of his stuff lately is kind of,
I think, and this is why it's on my honorable mention. I think Starting Strength is a good one to have and to peruse and to maybe even read if you're super new. But between those two, you'll walk away from Practical Programming with a better idea of how to, you know, wink, wink, practically program for somebody when it comes to strength, and
also,
it's intentionally for strength.
Did you see the series of videos? I don't remember what page it was on. It's like Mark Ripiteau sitting at a desk, just like making people mad.
That's like what he does. That's his whole thing.
It's like, it was all over Instagram for a while, and it was mostly him saying that like strength is the only thing that's important. And I don't know. It was just,
he's one of those guys that's done a real lot. I think he's done a lot for the industry, but I also think it's like, you know, chill out a little bit.
Yeah, probably.
I'll also, before I throw it back to you, I would also shout out Andy Baker's blog in general for just as an extension of that book. So if you do find yourself looking at that book, and it's not super long, and you just kind of want to have a really solid, I mean, even now, 10 years from probably having read it for the first time, I still refer to his website and go back and kind of look and see what he's putting out. And actually, asterisks on that, he's a veteran. I think we could probably get him on as a future guest. So
nice.
2 for 2 on books.
All right,
and
my turn?
Possible guests. Yes, your turn. Number two.
Okay. This one starts with a story.
Ooh.
When I was a platoon leader, I was all about like trying to like incentivize things with the soldiers. And one of the things I did is I created like a platoon like reading list, and like people were allowed to add books to the reading list if they wanted to. I brought in like a whole bunch of books, put them on a shelf outside my office. If you read one book and write like a 1 or 2 page like thing explaining what the book's about, what you took away from it, you get a half day off. If you read 2 books and write 2 things about it, you get a full day off of work. Nobody ever achieved the full day off of work.
What?
I did not successfully get my soldiers to read any books. I did get one, like one soldier came in and was like, I want to do this. Like, I haven't read any books since high school. I want to read a book.
But your soldiers and, read?
Yeah. These like half my soldiers had master's degrees. I don't think they gave a shit about my professional reading list. It's fine. Turns out lieutenants shouldn't be making professional reading lists.
I was going to say, like, junior
nobody
leaders
cares.
Reading list?
Nobody cares. that's fine though.
That's such
whatever.
An optimistic flex.
Listen, I was idealistic. It's
hey
okay.
Guys, I'm new here. Here's my professional reading list.
Listen, I mean, I did. So that's not true. I did get them read a book that's later on this list. We did do like a whole LPD thing on one of these books, and we'll come back to that. But this particular book, one of my soldiers walked in, said he like really did want to read like one of the books in the reading list, and asked which the shortest book on the list was, so he could get through it the easiest. And this was that
off, dude.
This was that book. It is extremely short. It is the one book, not the one book, but it is on a very short list of books that I think like basically everyone ever could derive some value from. Like it would make your life better and help you think about certain things. The book is Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. I won't dig too deep into it. Like I said, it's really short. He is a Holocaust survivor, and that is what the book is about. But it helped me navigate the like figure out what you want to do with your life kind of stuff, and like figure out a sense of purpose kind of stuff, because that's what it's really about. Is it's not like chasing achievement doesn't really work out super well. Chasing a sense of purpose does and may secondarily lead to some of that achievement. I think it's really valuable. It's intense, it's dark, but it does make some really useful points about human nature. I just gave a class this morning where you're talking about like hierarchy of what's important when it comes to health and performance and things like that. And I've, at least for the last couple of years, kind of believed that mindset is the foundation of that pyramid. Like if you haven't figured out your mindset and some sense of purpose kind of stuff, you're going to struggle with the rest of it. And so this book's pretty core to the figuring out your mindset, identifying a sense of purpose. And I think that's foundational to a lot of the other stuff we talk about in the performance space.
I think it's also a pretty safe bet that if somebody is writing a book during the Holocaust, it's probably worth reading.
I mean, I think he probably wrote the book after the Holocaust. I don't think he was like typing.
I thought he like was writing it.
I think he was. That's a good question. I need to go check.
Give us a Google.
Like started the work.
Give us a Google, Jamie. Look it up, Jamie.
We need a Jamie for our podcast.
You're Jamieing right now. I'm fairly confident he was. Maybe I'm thinking of a different Holocaust book. Because there's
Let's
a few.
Let's see. Dun, 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 dun. I don't think he wrote it during the Holocaust, man.
I mean, I could be wrong. I wasn't there. But regardless, he survived it. And then either wrote about it during or after.
Yeah. It focuses on like his experiences between 1942 and 1945, but he wrote it in 1946.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. So like, you know, right after.
Yeah.
Pretty close. The point remains, if somebody is taking some sort of philosophical meaning from the Holocaust, it's probably worth reading. Cool. Okay. So that was number two.
There you go. Your turn.
My turn. So I'll go sort of along the same lines of my last one, which was one of the things that I sought out very early on was a endurance equivalent to starting strength or practical programming. And I actually remember even asking some sort of mentors and more senior coaches, like, man, is there an endurance equivalent to starting strength? Because what starting strength, like I mentioned, had done for me and what practical programming had done for me is that it had made programming X's and O's very practical, very easy to understand. And what I kept coming back to over and over again from an endurance standpoint was The Science of Running by Steve Magnus. So I would say that it's probably around the same length as practical programming. It's one of those that probably would sit on your shelf and you'd refer to it, you know, time and again. One of the reasons I like it is that it's effectively written. There's two parts. The first part is the physiology of running or endurance training. And the second part takes that physiology and kind of makes it practical. So it gets into more of the programming side of things. And for me at that time, where I was at in my career, I really had not had any exposure to endurance training. I didn't do any sort of track work as a student in high school. In graduate school, we did not really spend any time, unfortunately, doing any sort of endurance type stuff. It was mostly team sport. So this was a really, really good resource. I will also give kudos to Steve in this work, because I think of all your kind of mainstream-ish strength and conditioning, whatever, training texts, it's one of the few that actually I would argue has a really contemporary portrayal of physiology. So it's not the outdated energy system stuff. It's not just your, oh, anaerobic, aerobic, lactic. He actually talks about how oxygen plays more of a role in that. And I think if I remember correctly, he actually even references MOXIE, which if you're unfamiliar is one of the early devices that was measuring nitric oxide, which again, sort of tangent, but if you think back to the Evan Picon episodes we've done with energy systems, that's all sort of related. So that to me was sort of a green flag or a check in the box of like, okay, at least his philosophies and his training methodologies are coming from an appropriate foundation of physiology. I will say that the programming examples that he gives, some of them just like don't make any sense. And as long as you know that going into it, I would sit there and try and reverse engineer the programming based on what I had read in some of the earlier chapters. And I was like, this doesn't, I don't understand what's going on. But when I realized that that was a common experience amongst my peers, it was like, okay, that's fine. But if you are a young coach listening to this, or if you are an athlete who just wants to learn more about strength and conditioning and training, I think those two books, Practical Programming and The Science of Running, will like, you'll be in a really good place. So Steve Magnus, shout out, Science of Running.
Any honorable mentions, or my turn?
Related to that one?
Mm-hmm.
No, I'll save the rest. Well, ooh, actually, okay, I see what you did there. 80-20 running. Yeah, no, 80-20 running did make the cut for me for an honorable mention, Matt Fitzgerald. So just real quick on that one, the 80-20, there's several of these. There's 80-20 running, there's 80-20 triathlon. I think there's 80-20 cycling too, maybe. But those are basically, you know, the 80-20 principle, which is 80% of your running should be sort of easy zone two type stuff. 20% should be hard. True or not, I don't know. But I like the 80-20 stuff because they also, all of them come with and kind of lead to the website that they have that just has a ton of pre-made endurance training sessions you can pull from. You talk about plug and play. I think you can get away with a little bit more plug and play with endurance stuff than you can with gym based stuff. Somebody might shoot me for saying that, but if you want to look at just some different interval structures for speed work versus endurance work, that is all kind of caged within the 80-20 universe. So that book, I think, gets the honorable mention. But if you just wanted one book on endurance training, I would go with The Science of Running.
All right. I'm actually going to go back and clean up an honorable mention that I should have mentioned before. I said that John Rady's follow-up book to Spark, Go Wild, is about kind of the role that nature plays in all this stuff. And there is another one that I highly recommend in terms of how nature influences health and fitness. And that is The Nature Fix by Florence Williams.
I don't know that one.
It digs into a similar topic. It gets into some stuff that's going on around the world. If people have heard the term forest bathing, it dives into that topic a little bit. You might have heard some of the science about how like patients in hospital rooms that have windows that can see nature recover more often and faster. Even things as ridiculous as like the number of trees you see in a day has a strong correlation with both your mood and your physical health.
See, that's why where I live and running into deer on the way to work correlates with mental health too. I mean, it just pisses you off, but nature.
Yeah, maybe. There you go.
I'm with you.
All right. That one's checked off the list.
We should get her on too. That'd be a cool.
That would be a good one.
Look at us.
Might be worth a try. I mean, basically all of these are potential.
Yeah, the ones that are alive, because I have some that are.
Yeah, that's true. Shall I continue?
Please.
Okay. My next one, and this one is probably like the farthest away on paper from health and fitness. I mean, it's not really about it at all. To a certain degree, it's kind of about politics a little bit, but really it's about psychology. The book is How Minds Change by David McRaney. He is a psychologist. That's his background. And the book is about like why people believe the things they believe and what actually leads to them changing their minds. And why do I have it on a list for a conversation about books related to health and fitness? Because I think so much of what we end up doing is trying to change people's behaviors and trying to change people's priorities and things like that, and really trying to change people's opinions on a variety of things, or at least what they consider important. And a lot of people go about that really wrong. One key way we screw it up is that we try and change people's minds using logic. And if you read McRaney's book, you will find that that is more likely to harden the opinion that they already have than it is to change their mind. So it digs into some strategies for actually changing people's mind. I won't like ruin the book for people, but a lot of it has to do less with figuring out what they believe and convincing them of a different thing. And it has more to do with figuring out why they believe what they believe and navigating through that. I know that sounds weird. You'll get it if you read the book. But it does dive in. It talks to some like conspiracy theorist people who I like, came away from it like to the extreme of there is like a whole segment with a person who left the Westboro Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. Like, why did they change their opinion on that?
Google that if you don't know what that is.
Yeah, if you're not familiar with Westboro Baptist Church, good for you. You're probably a happier person than those of us who are aware of them.
Go look at some trees. It'll make
it's
you
wild.
Better.
Yeah. So maybe don't Google it. It'll make you really mad. But there's a lot of stuff. And my parts of it, they work with like people who work on canvassing for political issues. But most of it is just diving into the psychology of opinion change. And I think that's really, really important in the health and wellness and fitness space. People have heard me talk about it before. I nerd out about like Bloom's taxonomy of learning, cognitive versus psychomotor versus affective domain. This book is a great strategy guide to affective domain education stuff.
Beautiful. That's How Minds Change by David McCraney.
There you go.
You know, I'm gonna riff off of that, and I'm gonna jump to my next one, speaking of changing people's minds, and that will be one that I know I have mentioned on here more than once. And it is The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn. People who know me will know that I recommend this book all the time. People who trust me will have actually read it and then probably gotten upset with me because of how boring they find it. And that's fine. Good for you. But this is a book that has absolutely nothing to do with exercise science whatsoever. It was written in, I believe, the 60s. The book or the link that I'll have in the show notes for you guys will take you to the 50th anniversary edition that has an awesome intro by Ian Hacking, who is another, I guess, scientific philosopher. So bit of background, philosophy of science is kind of one of the things that I think is super interesting. It just gets into sort of the idea behind science and how we think the way we think and why things are the way that they are. And I think this was a book that I picked up on from listening to a podcast that featured John Kiley and Mike Teixeira. And I forget who was interviewing them, but they were on there together. And those are two people that I hold in a very high regard. And if I recall, the guy had asked them like what their top book was, and they, you know, they did sort of a 1, 2, 3 go, and they both referenced this book. And so I got on Amazon within 10 seconds and bought it and read it. Effectively, this book, as dense as it is, it's not very long.
You read it in 10 seconds?
I read it in 10 seconds. Yeah. No, as dense as it is, what it's really getting at is how scientific paradigms change, how paradigms change. And Thomas Kuhn is actually, I think, credited with bringing the phrase paradigm shift or paradigm change into sort of the vernacular. So if you think back to the 60s, physics was sort of the predominant scientific domain at the time. And what he does is walk us through sort of the history of science and how, you know, in any given time, in any given century, you think about like Galileo, for example, like that body of expertise was dead convinced that they had it figured out and that they were right. And how does that change over time? And, you know, what do they say? Science, people change their minds one funeral at a time or something. Scientific ideas die one funeral at a time. To me, this book was, I probably first read this book maybe 6 or 7 years ago, but why I think it's relevant is because, again, thinking of paradigm shifts and this idea that massive changes in thinking don't ever really come from within the institution. They come from ideas on the outside of the institution that then slowly become accepted as institutional. And for me, as a young strength coach in the tactical strength and conditioning space, early on, I started kind of thinking about how the tactical athlete is fundamentally different from a football player, a basketball player, or, you know, whatever the sort of quote unquote institutional NSCA philosophies were. Those didn't apply to tactical athletes. And so what would it look like to sort of change the mind of an entire industry? So that was my maybe connection here between some of the things that I think about and where this book fits in my philosophical canon, if you will. Again, fair warning, totally unrelated to human performance. I doubt Thomas Kuhn ever even worked out, but a fantastic book. There are actually, and if I do a good job of this, I'll have it in the show notes, but there, there are a couple really good Reader's Digest kind of breakdowns of what the book's actually talking about. So you might start there. You might start on Wikipedia just to get a sense of what he's trying to get at before you dive into the book itself. But yeah, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, I have referred that book to countless people and they've all told me that it's boring.
Drew's given like academic homework here. That's like borderline textbook territory.
Yeah. So, you know, file your book reports and you'll get a half day off if you work for First Lieutenant.
There you go.
Alex.
Once upon a time. Those were the good days. I miss it.
Jesus.
All right. My turn.
Go for it. Number four.
Yeah. Like I said, I was surprised at when I made my list and hacked off the ones I didn't think made the top five, how many mental health books ended up in there. And this is, once again, not just a potential guest, but this is a guest we have tried and failed to get before. I looked up, so he is the chairman emeritus of the psychology department at Duke University. I went on their website, looked up his email address, sent him an email at his like normal faculty email address that's listed on there. I don't think the email even went through. I don't think the account actually exists. So then I engaged with some folks who had connections at Duke. They found me his actual email address, which is very strange. It's like, it's a name, but it's not his name, but it's what's listed in their like internal address book. And I sent an email to that email and also did not get a response that time either.
Next time you're in town, we'll just drive up to Durham and knock on his door.
It's not a bad idea. I don't know when this episode's going to publish. It'll probably be too late, but I will be in the Durham area not that long.
Well, there you go.
Come out to North Carolina. We'll hang out. But the book, anyway, and we'll talk about who the author is. The book is called Saving Normal, and it's by Dr. Alan Francis. Like psychotherapy, mental health kind of stuff, extremely accomplished in that space. He participated. So if people know anything about mental health, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, is the like where they derive their diagnoses from and the criteria for those diagnoses.
It's a big book.
It's a very big book. It's gone through many editions. He helped with DSM-3. He wrote the personality disorders section of that, along with a couple other roles.
Which, to be clear, means that that is the criteria used to diagnose everyone to diagnose that particular thing. So
yeah,
maybe that's why he's hard to get a hold of.
Probably. he was the chair of the task force. So he like ran the entire effort to write DSM-4. He was the guy for DSM-4. And if you read Saving Normal, this is about the time where he started wondering what this was all about and if there were some problems in the process. He would describe himself probably, and others have described him as a diagnostic conservative. He was not a big fan of like rapid expansion and like vague diagnostic criteria that could allow people to diagnose kind of anything. So he had some issues with how this went.
Shout out VA episodes.
Yeah, absolutely. So this connects to some other stuff we talked about for sure. Then we got to DSM-5. I don't think he was directly involved in the writing of it. I think he did. Yeah, well, while DSM-5 was being crafted, while that task force was working on it, he started a weekly blog titled DSM-5 in Distress, basically criticizing the whole process. His core argument was that they were trying to medicalize everything in order to prescribe as many drugs as possible and create as much business for psychologists as possible and drive all this stuff. It wasn't particularly helpful. And if you read Saving Normal, he breaks into a few examples of these issues. One of the big ones he talks about is ADHD, like overdiagnosis of ADHD, unclear standards for diagnosing ADHD, and the long-term ramifications of taking someone who is probably within the realm of normal and just needed to like figure some things out and diagnosing them and putting them on drugs and convincing them that they are mentally unwell. Like just there's long-term consequences of that. So that's what Saving Normal is all about. If you've heard the term worried well, there's a good chance it came from Dr. Francis. Needless to say, he's been very critical of the whole process.
I'm scrolling through his blog and some of the titles that stand out. Dying well means dying at home. Think twice before getting knee surgery. Balancing patient freedom with safety and well-being. A checklist to stop misuse of psychiatric medication in kids.
It's heavy stuff, man.
Heavy stuff. But
if you've heard me say the phrase, I made a post about this a long time ago that seemed to piss off some people. It didn't really piss off followers of Mops and Mo's, but some people came in from like across the internet to tell me how terrible a person I was that aren't in this space at all. But the way I summarize it is some of the things that we label as disorders are actually totally appropriate responses to broken systems. And you'll hear that, like, if a kid has trouble sitting still and focusing on PowerPoint slides for like 8 hours in a classroom all day, that is not a disorder with the child. That is a problem with the educational environment we have created. And that same phenomenon happens a lot.
I say there's probably a lot of carryover to military environments and working with
real
junior soldiers. Maybe a stone will unturn in future conversation. So that was Saving Normal by Alan Francis. Hopefully a future guest of the pod. Alan, if you're listening, respond please to Alex's emails. If somebody knows Alan, tell him we're looking for him.
Help us out. Thanks.
Help us out. Okay. So my next one, this will be, man, this is a niche corner of the strength and conditioning industry. If people out there are familiar with Hammer Media, HMMR Media, you might be familiar with Martin Bingisser. I might be pronouncing that wrong. He's Swiss. But the book here is called Training Talk: Conversations with a Dozen Master Coaches. It is not very long, 228 pages, but this is, I think, my favorite just sort of go-to little pocket guide for how a lot of highly respected coaches think. So Hammer Media, just for a bit of background, stems from the hammer throwing kind of track and field space. And I even just today was talking to a coach about how the track and field space is probably the most underutilized in terms of available resources for your run-of-the-mill strength and conditioning coach. If you want to know how to work with athletes, look at track and field coaches, because you're looking at singular events, single modalities. They have figured out how to optimize, whether that's sprinting, throwing, jumping, being strong, being powerful. So this book is cool because it features 12 different coaches, and I'll just throw a few out there if you know the names. Vern Gambetta, fantastic coach. Dan Pfaff, speed coach extraordinaire. Pat Connolly, Anatoly Bondarchuk. So we've mentioned his name before, but he was the guy that kind of inspired Mike Tashier looking at not necessarily rate of perceived exertion in strength and conditioning, but this idea of, I mean, maybe he's sort of one of the influencers behind emergent periodization and just sort of not getting too far ahead of the athlete and programming based off of their performances. So Bondarchuk, huge influence. Derek Evely, he was the guy. So Bondarchuk is, I'm pretty sure he's Russian. He's definitely Soviet, but he immigrated over to Canada, lived in Derek Evely's basement, and Derek was the guy that helped translate all of his stuff into English. So just sort of an interesting aside. Derek's also featured in that. Franz Bosch is on here. My favorite, John Kiley, is on here. So the book's divided into two parts. Part one is at the track, and you've got seven coaches kind of detailing how they approach that space. And then part two is on the field, and you've got five coaches detailing how they navigate that space. So this is everything from, and I'm reading this from the description, but the training methods behind Japan's historic upset of South Africa in the 2015 Rugby World Cup, which, if you don't know that story, is fantastic. It basically just looks at how the top coaches do what they do and why they do it. And it's conversational. So it's Martin, you know, talking to them talking back, almost like a podcast transcript. And I think of all the books I have, this is probably the most highlighted. So if you are looking kind of in a similar vein to what I mentioned with Thomas Kuhn's book, if you're looking for some really insightful knowledge outside of the traditional institutional viewpoint of NSCA strength and conditioning, this is a place that I would go. So that is Training Talk. If you can't find it on Amazon, you can find it on Hammer Media. And like I said, we'll have that in the show notes. So boom.
Awesome. Last one for me.
Last one.
Other than a couple honorable mentions that we'll wrap up at the end. At this point, you're probably realizing all of Drew's books are actually about strength and conditioning, and zero of my books are about strength and conditioning. Sorry about that. If you've been listening to the podcast for this long and not realized that like what I do is not that much the X's and O's of strength and conditioning, surprise. Like,
I was surprised at how many I was able to do as strength and conditioning, because I expected my list to be none, but here we are.
Yeah. Anyway, my last book is frankly extremely predictable. I kind of made fun of Drew for being basic with practical programming. This would be my most basic on the list, I think. I think it's particularly relevant if you are somebody who is new to working around the military. But frankly, it has relevance outside of just the military. I have like a theory of like human culture kind of stuff that I'll dig into in a second that kind of came from this book. But it's Tribe by Sebastian Younger. Again, it's a relatively quick read. Sebastian Younger was like an embedded reporter, talked about what he saw in combat, has written a number of really, really good books, involved in some documentaries and things like that. You probably know his work.
Restrepo.
You don't realize. Yeah, he was the Restrepo guy. You almost certainly know his work, even if you don't necessarily recognize his name. But I would highly encourage people to read Tribe. Kind of a core theme of Tribe is that, I mean, it's kind of about PTSD, and it was controversial when it came out for a couple reasons. The most notable reason that it was controversial is it highlighted the fact that, one, PTSD is not necessarily like an unhealthy thing. It's a pretty normal reaction to traumatic stress. But two, that it is a, generally speaking, temporary condition that you can recover from. And that was a frustrating thing. We've done two episodes now on the whole VA disability system, but a lot of people did not want to hear that it's something you can recover from, because that sounds like a threat to their long-term disability payments for PTSD. But it is something, like, lots of people experience PTSD that aren't in the military. You can get PTSD from car accidents. You can get PTSD from violent crime stuff. It happens all the time. People recover from it. It just turns out that people who get paid for it are less likely to recover from it. Again, that's a whole rabbit hole. We've done two episodes on that. Go listen to those. But one of the core things from Tribe is that societies used to go to war as societies or as communities. It was something that the entire community participated in to some degree, even if they weren't all quote unquote warriors. And then when the conflict was over, they recovered from that experience of violence as a society, as a community together. And that was true even up through like World War II, like the whole country was involved in the war effort and things like that. And that sense of community involvement in conflict and in war has to a significant degree gone away. And that's a core part of the reason that people have a hard time recovering from it, because they go through something violent and traumatic like that, and then they return to a community where they're supposed to just pretend everything's fine and nobody that is around them understands what they're talking about. My broader theory that I took away from it is that from an evolutionary standpoint, I don't think humans were really ever intended to live in communities larger than like 40. And that's where most of our problems come from, is that we're trying to be part of this like multiple billion person global community. And you're never going to get that many people to agree even on foundational things, but that's not technically really part of the book.
War was the other book you wrote.
War is fantastic. It's longer. It's longer than Tribe. But
I was going to say, Tribe is relatively short. War was the one that came from Restrepo, right?
Yeah. I strongly recommend War. It's really, really good, but it's kind of a different direction and more focused on like the actual military component of the whole thing rather than like the health wellness part of it.
I think Sebastian Younger has probably the best Blue Steel.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah. I think of all the authors on our list. If you Google him, his first picture, you'll see it. You'll melt.
He's got a crush.
Cool. So yeah, a little bit of a crush. So there's Alex's five: Spark, Man's Search for Meaning, How Minds Change, Saving Normal, and Tribe. So for my fifth, I could go two ways with this. I have John Kiley's Periodization Papers, which probably people are getting sick of me saying this, but that's the subject of this podcast. So if papers count, then I would say to the listener, you should go and read these three. It would all by John Kiley. It would be A New Understanding of Stress, Periodization Paradigms in the 21st Century, and then Periodization Theory Confronting an Inconvenient Truth. Those three papers, and again, I was literally just having this conversation today or yesterday. Those three papers combined are one of the few things in my career where I can think I took a complete turn in a different direction after having read them. So with the subject of tonight's podcast being five books that kind of shaped our thinking, I think I would be remiss not to mention those. Now, if you're screaming at your listening device saying that doesn't count as a book, that's fine. I came prepared. I would include Endure by Alex Hutchinson on this list. So you talked a lot about sort of the mental health component of your list. I don't think I would put Endure in the mental health category necessarily, but for folks that have not read that book, it effectively looks at the mental, maybe even biopsychosocial component of endurance. And I don't know if it's intentionally meant specifically to be about only endurance, because there is some talk of kind of other endeavors, but
it is titled Endure.
It is titled Endure. Alex is a runner. Alex Hutchinson is a runner. I think he, prior to, or maybe as a result of this, he also writes for, I know he writes for Outside. He might write for Sports Illustrated too. I'm not sure. He's a journalist by trade, but anyway, a fantastic book that I think gives you a great idea of the role that the mind plays in performance. And one of the anecdotes that he includes in this, I think it might actually be in the introduction, was when he himself was a competitive runner, I believe in college. It's that thing of the coach like shouting out the wrong time and him thinking that he was faster or maybe slower than what he thought he was, and kind of how that allowed him to overcome whatever his PR had been. And I was laughing because I was thinking of myself when I remember this distinctly, when I first bench pressed 225, and I know people are, oh, like last week. No, like when I very first bench pressed 225, the reason that happened was because I thought I had put a 35 on top of the 45, and it was actually 245s. And so there I was, having inadvertently loaded 225, thinking that it was a lighter weight, and then completing the rep. And that experience basically sums up what that book is about.
Man, you've queued up three different tangents for me right now.
the fact that you're working on benching 225?
Nah, goddamn it, Drew.
sorry. I'm not done because I have a funny story.
My bench max is not that much higher than 225. I'll admit that. But so, I will knock out one really fast. Mark Taysom, friend of the pod, previous guest.
Dr. Seuss of Strength.
Used to frequently, like if people were going for a one rep max, particularly on deadlift, he would take care of loading up their weight for them. And he would just lie to them about what weight was on the bar. Mm-hmm. And then they would pull more than they thought they could pull. That happened all the time.
And that, again, kind of effectively is what that is about. And so what's interesting is so Alex Hutchinson, he did some of the reporting on the original attempt for Eliud Kipchoge to break the 2-hour marathon. So if you guys have followed that at all, it's kind of been a really fascinating story. It has since been broken, but the first attempt that they made, everything was structured to optimize this goal of the sub 2-hour marathon. They had it on a Formula One track in the perfect climate, perfect elevation, behind a Tesla with I think lasers were sort of on the ground to give the pace, and then they structured the pacers in a particular formation to break the wind, and everything was optimized. But and I actually emailed Alex just out of curiosity, and I said, Alex, why didn't they lie to them about their time? Like, why was their time broadcast in front of them the whole time? Do you think that they could have tricked them? And because I think that Eliud finished like 2 hours and 2 minutes. It was minuscule. And he got back and it took him a couple months, but he got back and he said that at that level, those guys are so keyed in to how the pace feels at that, you know, speed, that they would have known the difference in like 1 or 2 seconds per mile. So I thought that was super cool. Again, just kind of, I think, a testament to the role that the mind plays in either overcoming certain things or actually creating certain obstacles. So that rounds out my five.
Before you go off on anything else, I know there's some honorable mentions to mention, but that brings up some of Ellen Langer's research as well. We didn't dig into it too much on the podcast we did with her, but that lab has done, I don't know if it was her or students in her lab or something, but they've had several replications of the same phenomenon where you challenge people to a task, lie to them about how well most people perform or how much a lot is, and it will dramatically change at what point they start to identify fatigue and at what point they fail.
Mm-hmm. Same.
Because they have, you changed their frame of reference on what a lot is or what a normal amount of something is.
Interestingly, the same thing works when parenting toddlers.
Nice. The other one that's weird to me, and this is just, I only noticed it because of the show notes that Drew put together, the citation he has for that book, Alex Hutchinson's book, it does mention Malcolm Gladwell as an author as well.
Oh yeah.
All Malcolm Gladwell did was write the foreword. I had to go and check that to see whether he was like a collaborating author or anything. Just knowing the book space, like putting Malcolm Gladwell's name on your book helps your book sell really well. Malcolm Gladwell has admitted publicly that he doesn't really read the books he wrote forewords for, and he doesn't endorse them or really care, but he makes money off of all this stuff, so he does it. People hero worship Malcolm Gladwell. I really like some of his early stuff. Some of his stuff, especially in his podcast, was like way less vetted than some of his early stuff. One of the like the core stories people attribute to Malcolm Gladwell is like the David and Goliath thing, and he makes some good points there about how like at the time that the David and Goliath story happened, people probably would have assumed that David would beat Goliath. It's not actually like what people think. People think that like they would have assumed Goliath would have won, but there's reasons to believe that Goliath was probably developmentally handicapped and stuff like that. And like people using slings were actually super lethal and stuff.
I saw a video on Instagram. Maybe it was, yeah, Instagram.
The guy with the sling?
Dude, the comment was like, and I thought, Dave, like, you look at a guy who is like genuinely.
No, Goliath had no chance.
Watch somebody sling us, like, watch an Arabic shepherd sling a rock. It is insane.
Yeah. People just underestimate what slings are capable of. But
no.
But he's gone in some weird directions. I can't remember what school it was.
Was he the 10,000 hour guy?
I don't.
Did he come up with that?
So. He might have been like involved in some of that stuff, but like he's all about like reframing the way people think about certain stories.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he like there was a podcast episode where he went
Outliers. After, like, Outliers talks about that. That was Malcolm Gladwell.
Yeah. And when I was an intel officer, they used to recommend Malcolm Gladwell books all the time for like helping you think creatively, whatever, whatever.
I mean, that's cool.
The one that kind of set me off when I first started to like dig deeper on some of his stories, I think he went after Bowdoin or maybe a different school, some school in the Northeast. He went after their like cafeteria for some reason and like the way they approach student aid and some things. And he just like straight up made up a bunch of stuff to make it look worse for the school. And then like ignored the response from the school when they're like, hey, if you could stop like lying about us in a public forum, that'd be super cool. Just didn't do like any journalistic due diligence. And if you start to dig into some of his stuff, I think he started to like drink his own Kool-Aid and like think he was the most amazing person in the world.
So he's like an academic Andrew Huberman is what you're saying.
Yeah, to a certain degree. Yeah.
Man, you hate to see it. That goes along with the podcast I sent you this morning that you're not going to listen to about the prevalence of academic fraud in research.
If I'm not mistaken, you did just send me the link with like no context about why I should listen to it or what it was. And I had to go click the link to figure out what you were talking about.
Well, you would have listened to the episode and been like, oh, okay, I get this.
No, I'll go check it out. Cause I've been following the whole drama that's going on right now about like prevalence of plagiarism. And now
a
bunch of people are like starting investigations into different accomplished academics and stuff. It's a whole thing.
That might be why this episode popped up on my feed this morning.
My what's the guy, like Neri Oxman's husband, who's like a billionaire or something? I gotta check. Hold on. We need a Jamie for our podcast. Billionaire wife plagiarism.
Somebody wants to be the Jamie for our podcast for free.
Yeah.
Feel free to.
So it's Bill Ackman that I was thinking of. He like went after the Harvard president in the fallout from all the stuff that was going on with Harvard, MIT, and Penn, I think were the three. Is that right? Yeah, Harvard, MIT, and Penn. And then like he was going after the Harvard president for allegations of plagiarism and her previous stuff. And then people started to look at his wife's stuff because his wife is Neri Oxman, who's an accomplished academic. And it turns out she copy-pasted a bunch of stuff from Wikipedia in publications that she claimed and then didn't cite anything.
Womp womp.
Made it really awkward. That he like tried to claim that like taking stuff from Wikipedia isn't actually plagiarism because Wikipedia is like crowdsourced and not copyrighted. Then he tried to claim that everybody coming after his wife was ridiculous because she's like an introvert and just an academic and like not really out in the public space, but like she's very, very much in the public space. It's a whole ridiculous fight that might tear down all of academia in the process. So we'll see.
One could hope. So yeah, so my five: practical programming for strength training, the science of running, the structure of scientific revolutions, training talk, and depending on your definition of book, either the papers I mentioned from John Kiley or Endure by Alex Hutchinson. Hey guys, this next part is going to be the honorable mentions, and we're going to take a real quick break because we have to apologize for screwing up two authors' names. You will hear me call Mike Tashir Mark Tashir, which is wrong. Mike is his name. And you will hear both Alex and myself call Michael Pollan David Pollan. So his name is, in fact, Michael Pollan.
We have talked about both of these authors on previous episodes, and we got their names fine. We both own both of their books. We know who they are. I have no idea where any of this came from. Sorry.
Do you want to clean up your honorable mentions, and then I'll finish mine, and then we'll sign off?
Yeah, we can knock out some honorable mentions. I do want to mention, I keep saying the word mention. I've said it so many times.
I was going to just let that happen.
I can't. I don't know what else. I don't know what other word to use. But this, as I think about my list, it brings me back to a point that comes up in some of the DMs I get from people on the Instagram page a lot.
But you should mention it.
You're killing me. A lot of people want to know like kind of what the trick is to getting a performance program to work. And they all seem to assume it has something to do with like what kinds of professionals you hire or what program you create, whatever, whatever. And all that stuff matters to a certain degree. Certainly you want a team that's knowledgeable and cares, and you want workouts that make sense, whatever, whatever. But I would argue that much more foundational than any of those things is the culture you create around performance. Like if your leaders are walking the walk and not just talking the talk and just clearly care about it, you could do a pretty bad program without any professional assistance. But if you have leaders who really care about it and get the people who follow them to care about it, you're going to end up at a place with some pretty high performance. And I think that kind of explains some of my selections on this list, because they're much more about why you should care about this stuff, finding a sense of purpose, how to get people on board with something you're trying to create, and building communities. So that's just, I think that makes my list make a little more sense, hopefully.
What are your honorable mentions?
Let's do it. I'll do two of them. I know you have a couple more than me, I think. One of them is This Is Your Mind on Plants by David Pollan. I think when I first heard the title of the book, I thought it was about like vegetarian or vegan diets. It is not.
It's about drugs.
It is specifically about three drugs. It's about opium, caffeine, and mescaline. And I think a military audience might perk up when they hear there's a whole book about caffeine and the history of caffeine and how caffeine works.
So you mentioned opium, caffeine, and mescaline. That's basically aphes.
Yeah, right. But it's worth a read. If you have even like slight hippie tendencies like I do, you will end up hating the DEA by the end of the book and like realizing the hypocrisy involved in the drug regime in our country and around the world. Caffeine is like really only legal because the people who run giant companies know that it makes workers more productive. It all has to do with like industrial revolution kind of stuff. And like other drugs are illegal, not because they're bad for you or dangerous, but because they probably make you a less productive worker.
Dude, David Pollan will screw you up.
Yeah,
in a good way. Like when
he's written a lot of books. People can dive into any of his.
When
other
I
stuff.
Saw him on your list, I'm sorry, I'm stealing your microphone, but I'm gonna add one to yours, which is Omnivore's Dilemma.
Yeah,
talk about a book that will change how you think about food. I'm actually right now, I'm literally reading my third consecutive David Pollan book. I'm currently reading Cooked. So I read In Defense of Food. I then read Omnivore's Dilemma. I'm now reading Cooked. And I have fundamentally changed the way that I think about food.
Yeah. And I mean, that's probably good for our list that we just incorporated nutrition in it. So there we go.
That's why I did that. And I'll dive a little deeper on my honorable mentions, but I'm going to add that to mine.
Fair. So that one's on mine. I think just learning a little bit more about how your brain works and about how like the history of humans turning to substances that affect the way your brain works. It's a good book. It's worth reading. The caffeine stuff is super interesting. And then my last one, if we record this episode in a couple of weeks, this one might be on my top five list. I've put it on my honorable mentions list just because I have not finished the book. I'm reading it because Drew brought it up. I'm also reading it because Drew really wants to get the author of this book on the podcast.
He is hard to get a hold of as well.
Yeah,
mostly he's a huge deal.
Famous. Yeah, he'd be hard for us to get. Again, if any listeners are out there and I happen to know Robert Sapolsky,
oh, I was going to say out. Brad Pitt, but yeah.
Sure. We'll take Brad Pitt on the podcast too. But the book is Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And I can't remember which book it was that Drew was talking about on his list and said it was his most highlighted book.
Training Talk.
Even without finishing this book, it might now be my most highlighted book.
Very good book.
There's so many examples in the book of it addressing the way most people think the science looks on something, explaining why it's wrong, then explaining the like contemporary understanding of it among people who actually research that topic in a way that's easy to understand, even if you're not in that space scientifically. It's got like countless examples of that that are really, really good. Fundamentally, it's about stress, mm-hmm. What stress is, our understanding of stress, how stress affects your body. But it breaks it down into a whole bunch of different subtopics of stress. Just really, really good. Like I said, I haven't finished it, so I don't want to like, I recently read a book where I really liked the first half of it and then really didn't like the back half of it. I'm pretty confident that I'm going to like this whole book based on things I've heard from other people, but strongly recommend it. Just haven't put it on my top five because I have not finished it.
It's fair. It's very admirable of you. Let yourself finish it before you decide. Okay, my honorable mentions. I mentioned two already, Starting Strength and 80-20 Running. I'm going to throw Training for the New Alpinism on there. So Scott Johnston is one that we have had on the podcast before. He's a longtime mentor of mine. Steve House was also a co-author on that one. And I think of all the guys that I have worked with coaching one-on-one, so of all the athletes that I've worked with, Training for the New Alpinism is the one that comes up the most in terms of having kind of turned them on to the idea of zone two training. And so while it is, you know, you can kind of figure this out from the title, it is designed more for alpinism. So it was really the first book in the high altitude climbing space that tried to figure out how to train. Beforehand, people were just kind of climbing, and this was how to actually train for it. So definitely I suppose set the stage for that, the field of alpinism. But when it comes to zone two and understanding zone two, I mean, if you've listened to Scott's podcast, most of that is in that Training for the New Alpinism book. The next one I have is Winning, and this is another niche book. So this is by Clive Woodward. He was the coach of the 2003 Rugby World Cup winning England squad. And this is his book that basically explains the way that he built that winning culture for that team from around 1997 up until they won in 2003. So I initially read it because I like rugby, and then turns out it's a phenomenal book with regards to how to build a winning culture. And there's a lot of cool resources in there for team building. I think actually a lot of senior military leaders would probably do well to read that. And as I put that on there, speaking of rugby books that military people seem to love, we should have had Legacy on here somewhere, which is the book about the All Blacks, and, you know, sweeping the sheds and all that. Legacy is another book I'll throw in there.
Drew continues to make his list of books longer.
I know. And I'm pulling an Alex. I put Reactive Training Systems Manual on there by Mark Teixeira. A very, very small book, but that is the book that introduced rate of perceived exertion to resistance training. So again, I would be remiss if I did not include that. Mark Teixeira, great thought leader in the space. I mentioned John Kiley's stuff. I also included him in my honorable mentions just in case I was not allowed to have him as a book. And then the ones that I added on here, as you were talking about David Pollan, are In Defense of Food and Omnivore's Dilemma. So just to dive a little bit deeper into those as a shout out to the nutrition space. I think In Defense of Food came first. Maybe Omnivore's Dilemma did. Either way, both of those books kind of go at the world of dietary science and why we eat what we eat and the sort of culture around that. And you want to talk, like I mentioned, something, if you want to talk about something that will change your mind on whether it's drugs or food, this is definitely one of those books. I thought it was fascinating. People that work with me will be so annoyed because I've been referencing them probably endlessly for the last year. But that I think safely rounds out my honorable mentions before I start adding a bunch more on there.
All right. I think I'm going to give Drew some homework since he gave you guys some homework with all the textbook reading you're supposed to do. I'm going to need you to grab your top five, stack them up, take a picture of it, send it to me for the Instagram, and we'll do a reading list post and people can tell us what books we should have put on our list.
You know, it's funny you say that because I wasn't going to shout him out for this, but hopefully he's listening. Joffrey actually stole my training talk book off the shelf, so I don't have that one.
I am worried that I don't know. I'm going to turn around and look at my bookshelf. Listeners are not going to be able to see this. It's okay. I was worried that I did not have hard copies of a couple of these because I have a tendency to give them to people, especially Spark and Tribe. But I think I have both on the shelf. Yeah, we are good to go.
Just Photoshop them in there.
Yeah,
there you go. You could do one of the collage things.
That's true.
Because, yeah, I'm not going to have – I don't have training talk. It has been stolen.
You got homework. You got to figure it out.
Yeah, I'm just going to buy it again, I guess.
There you go.
Well, cool. Hopefully this was practical. Hopefully this was something useful. Hopefully at least one of these books we just mentioned appealed to you. And like I said, we'll have all of these in the show notes. We'll have links to all of them. And as we were doing this, I think maybe I'll build a page on the website with some recommended reading. Ooh. That'll kind of put you in a Mops and Mos headspace. So
a reading list page on the website would be a good idea. Reading list
page on the website. So stay tuned for that. Unless you got anything else, I think that wraps up the week.
No, I think the reading list page has got to include any like books by people who have been guests on our podcast. I think that would be appropriate to plug them a little bit, give them a shout out.
It'll be a living page.
And I'm looking forward to hearing from the audience all the reasons why our list is wrong and the books they like better should be on there.
Yeah. Yeah. So throw those in Alex's DMs as always. My Instagram now, not only is it private, it's also deleted from my phone. So I'm pulling who am I looking at? Alan Francis, trying to be hard to get a hold of. Go. But yeah, slide in Alex's DMs. Tell him why this list is wrong. Tell him what you would prefer to read. Tell him if you know how to read. Come back next week. Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter N, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.
Thank you.